This podcast is part of the Gunna Geek Network. The opinions expressed may not reflect those of other podcasts or affiliates of this show or Gunna Geek. Check out other geeky podcasts at gunnageek.com. Get ready because geekiness commences in 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio, podcast dedicated to everything Doctor Who. Join us each week for discussions ranging from Hartnell to Capaldi. I'm your host, Jay Whitten.
I prefer to jazzercise my demons, but yeah.
And Keir Hansen.
Gallifrey Public Radio. Now we have maths.
Spoilers.
We will be discussing news and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired. But if we get into anything too serious, don't worry. We'll warn you again.
Welcome to episode 79 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where tonight we find our trust, our adoration, and at times our very lives in the hands of some mop-headed madman who may approach a dangerous situation with keen intellect and scientific analysis, but just as likely he may just opt to bung a rock at it. I am Keir, joining you in the GPR studios this evening. With me is Jay. How are you, sir?
Doing great. How about yourself?
Outstanding. Been really looking forward to this.
Oh, yeah.
We are taking another step this week into our personal selections for what we consider to be the standout episodes of each of the gentlemen who have been fortunate enough to date to portray the Doctor and in their own way become part of this half-century legacy that draws us all together as Whovians. So in 1966, October of that year, Patrick Troughton took the mantle from who we consider to be the pioneer, William Hartnell, and his first television story was Power of the Daleks, which gets referenced by fans and critics alike with great adoration for turning the corner for the program and setting all new boundaries for what the show could be capable of, you know, as they were redefining it and realizing that they had to deal with a new actor playing the lead role and having to explain that away. But we were just discussing before we started recording tonight, this is one of the greatest pities. I consider it one of the greatest pities that a great percentage of all of Troughton's stories and episodes are among those that we consider to be the lost episodes, the lost material that the BBC archivists were unable to retain and restore over the last 40, 50 years. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, between Hartnell and Troughton, that's where the majority of them have just degraded into dust, or so we believe.
Right, right. But, I mean, you know, Troughton is given credit to, you know, bringing new life to the program in 1966, you know, all the way to 69, you know, bringing a strong presence and affability and a degree of comedic timing that bordered on professional clowning, really. I mean, we refer to him as the space hobo, and he really is just that. I mean, he was a comedic actor, and mm-hmm. he was known for that at the time. And then when they brought him into this, he definitely made that shine. You know, he's been, you know, Matt Smith himself has said that he was a personal inspiration. So, you yeah. know, we really enjoy a lot of his stuff, and we're hoping that, you know, we'll get more of it. You know, we just got 9 episodes of the material that was considered lost. So hopefully we'll get to see some more, because this really is some fantastic stuff that they gave Troughton.
Mm-hmm. And it's great to see that in the process of bringing into the public hands these lost episodes and doing some cleanup, to create DVD sets and things of that sort to promote those releases, they would go back and they would clean up the video and the audio quality that has been retained. Because we do have the audio for everything, obviously, that was right. in a different format and that was able to be retained. But to get that cleaned up as well, which gave you a better appreciation of some of the individual performances, some of the scores that were done in the episodes, sparse as they were. But it makes everything sort of, you know, breathe new life. So
yeah.
Great to have him. We noticed as we started going through and kind of putting, you know, earmarks on the episodes that we thought were some of the real exemplary ones, that they all kind of fell around the same period of time. Yeah. with one exception. I think we had one.
Yeah.
But they all kind of fell within what we consider to be, or what we would chronologically sort as the fifth and sixth seasons for the program. And I've got my theories as to why that is, but I guess each person can form their own opinions on what they think are some of the standouts, not to take anything away from any of the work that Troughton did. But these are just the ones that I personally felt jumped out from a writing perspective, a performance perspective, and just in terms of the grand scale of WHO history, really gave us a lot to work with.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, that's the fun of going back and revisiting a lot of these is, you know, you get to hit some of those episodes that, you know, you may not have hit you right the first time you saw it, or that you've heard about and never really had a chance to see. So, you know, visiting a lot of these has been a lot of fun. Some of these were my first viewing of them. Others I'd seen before and I just kind of went back and revisited. But I mean, all of them are, you know, they're quality episodes. They really are.
Yeah.
And they, when you think about it, I mean, there's a good reason for that. They had to bring a lot of story because you're taking a show that people loved. They really enjoyed that, you know, it was a huge popular success. And then you think, okay, let's yank the lead actor, the person that people know and love and have, you know, admire, and put somebody else in there and expect them to feel the same way. You know, it's like you've got to give them something to get through that transition because this is something that had never been done before.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's there's actually one of the listener comments we had, you know, our good mate Stargate Pioneer chimed in on this as we were asking folks to share their thoughts about the Troughton era in general and episodes in particular. And he actually said, you know, he's got to wonder what Troughton's mindset was, you know, what his preparations or what his, you know, how he approached this following Hartnell as a national star in the same role, because it was kind of unprecedented at the time. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what to prepare for, did that weigh on his mind, or did he just, you know, take the Geronimo approach and just leap into it?
Well, I mean, I think that, I think he knew what he was doing, but, you know, he didn't try to emulate Hartnell. He wasn't trying to play the same role. And that's something that we really do see, is he took the role and made it his own. You know, you have a character that's established, and then all of a sudden, not only are you getting a new face, but you're getting a new personality as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I think that was a great thing because I wouldn't really buy Troughton if he tried to play the Doctor as portrayed by Hartnell. You know, he was able to make it his own and make it feel like another really compelling character and yet the same person. You know, and this is something that we base the entire show off of now. You know, it's the same person with a different face and a different, you know, attitude, but we know it's the same man. And Troughton was able to pull that off.
Absolutely. It's one of the things that I think really, and we'll see this with some of the episodes that we chose. It's the fact that he was able to not only honor a lot of the aspects of Hartnell's interpretation of the character in terms of his, you know, his ingenuity and his rationalization and his scientific hunger and curiosity, but he sort of rounded the corners a bit in taking some of the curmudgeon out of it or some of the spiky reactions and responses that he would that Hartnell may have been characterized as taking in certain situations with the Doctor's character. And in, you know, injecting this degree of humor, this energy, this willingness to get up and run down corridors and leap down stairwells and whatnot, and just really put all of his physicality and a full emotional and physical investment into it. That I think you talk about the sort of it's interesting. It's almost a pun in and of itself. The adding new life to the program was exactly that. I mean, this here's somebody who
I see what you did there.
Yeah, well, I mean, 25 years his younger at the time, and jumping into it with a desire to shake things up, probably under specific direction to do so. You know, they knew that in the casting, that they were bringing in someone who was a comedic actor by training,
right?
Professional clown by training. I mean, this is something where you had an idea of what you were about to do to the viewing public, and it was a matter of really giving them, if they did not provide them with the quality writing that they did over the course of the next 3 years, we wouldn't be discussing this today.
Right. Yeah, because I mean, this could have been the death blow. This very easily could have been. I mean, how many times do you, you know, you're watching a show and they recast one of the characters and you're like, wait, what? No, that's not the same. Mm-hmm. I don't. And it just takes you out of it so much that all you're paying attention to is this new person that's trying to be your old person.
Right.
And here you have this happening to the lead actor. You know, right. It's not some secondary cousin that comes in every now and again and they throw jokes at. I mean, this is the person that you tune in to watch, and now he's got a new face. You know, mm-hmm. So, I mean, this very easily could have destroyed the show.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. There have been instances where there have been programs that I've walked away from because not just because of a change of characters, but just because of they eliminated a character. Mm-hmm. I'm not even saying recast someone in the same role. I'm just talking you decide to swap out. Okay, your next door neighbor is no longer going to be that redheaded guy with the goatee beard. This is now going to be, you know, the curly headed guy who always wears sweatpants. And just because that dynamic has changed, you know, it's a different character entirely. But the program has fundamentally changed, and I write it off. You know, or they've decided they're just going to eliminate a character and come up with some sort of a creative way to write them out at the end of the next series. I'm thinking, I'm even going to blame Stephen Moffat for this on Coupling. Mm-hmm. You know, there was a whole fourth season of Coupling where they decided to get rid of the Jeffrey character and the whole dynamic was shattered and I stopped watching.
Yeah.
So now you're going to do that and you're going to intensify it and say, whoa, no, we're going to keep everything status quo. I'm just going to put this gentleman in here who looks and behaves and speaks and acts nothing like what you had before. Roll with us on it. It'll be fine.
Yeah. I mean, thankfully it worked. There was some kind of magic in there that made it happen. And people really did latch onto him.
Mm-hmm. I think a great degree of that has to be because of the flexibility and the multifaceted nature of Troughton's performances.
Yeah.
Because he was just instantly likable, regardless of what you were tuning into the show to see. If you wanted the adventure, if you wanted the suspense, if you wanted the mystery, the kind of the whodunit stuff, you had plenty of that. If you wanted something that was comedic, or if you wanted something that really required a bit of a thinker piece, he could bring all that to the table as needed. So, yeah. In saying that, we jump into what we narrow down to here. Lots of opportunities to choose from, but I think one of the first ones we chose here, which has recently just gotten a bit of recognition again, was Web of Fear from season 5. This was the 41st story in the sequence here.
Yeah, and I mean, this is a very popular one right now, like you said, just because this is the one of the ones that we found a lot of the episodes. This is the one of the two stories that just got released on iTunes and everywhere. And unfortunately, it's still missing the third episode. And this is something that you're going to run into with a lot of the stories in Troughton's run. You're going to have some, and you're going to miss one, two, three episodes sometimes. So there's always going to be these gaps. But thankfully, there's a lot of people doing restorations or reproductions and managing to fill those gaps so that we can at least have the story going again. But This one actually is a part of a recurrence of the Great Intelligence that we've come to see recently.
Yeah, and that's one of the things as I was going through and doing another viewing on it. It was great to have all of the recent memory of Great Intelligence that we've been dealing with through Series 7 and have all of this setup discussion of the fact that it is this non-corporeal villain that has been going through and assuming, taking over human bodies in order to track him down and manipulating, sort of secondary villains and or secondary enforcers, in the form of the robot Yetis in this case, to be able to go after the Doctor for reasons that we finally get some good understanding of. Maybe even something better than we got in the Snowmen to a certain degree. At that point, it just became almost blind vengeance.
Yeah.
But here we've got some of the real reasoning as to why the Great Intelligence was going after the Doctor with such a fervor, at least the way they had set it up back then, not knowing what the hell Steemo was going to be doing.
Well, yeah.
In the 21st century.
Not that we even still know what Steemo's doing half the time, but,
just eat your popcorn and smile.
It looks pretty, that's for sure.
So we've got, obviously, in most of the instances where you're running around with Troughton, you've got Jamie as the affable sidekick there.
Right.
Just a beautiful rapport with any time the two of these gentlemen share the screen together. And Victoria as our rather striking. Troughton always had, if there was going to be a third person on the TARDIS, she was going to be easy on the eyes.
Oh,
so we had Victoria in this one. And you could tell right from the beginning of it, right from the first episode of this six episode series, that they had just gotten out of a bad scrape in the previous story. And instantly, Doctor's fussing with the controls and asking them where they're headed next and flinging them off into danger again. When everyone else is telling them, can we just sit and breathe for 10 minutes? I'd like to eat my sandwich and take a nap if it's all right with you. And he's already flinging them off into who knows where.
Right.
I loved it. I mean, that was exemplary as far as I see the way that when he doesn't understand a situation, he would just dive right into it and start exploring.
Yeah. You know? And I mean, that's a central tenet of what really makes the Doctor. And I mean, it's something that, you know, it comes and goes with the different iterations and, you know, sometimes is a lot more intense. But I mean, that's something that Troughton really did understand in his portrayal and the writers as well. I mean, all the credit to them. But, you know, that is something that that helps to carry that character over.
Mm. And in terms of the character work that they had done, Victoria's a pretty rough and tumble. I give her a lot of credit. She was willing to get herself into the scrapes as well. She was a voice of reason from time to time, but she was definitely by no means ever really a damsel in distress,
right?
Because she was a little too bright to allow those sort of things to happen. We'll see that again with Zoe in another episode another story we're going to discuss. But you also partner her up. This is where we get this great return to Professor Travers.
Mm-hmm.
And his daughter. And I love the young Miss Travers' feminist brilliance. I mean, she is smart as a whip and is not going to be, you know, pushed around. This was great to see this strong of a female character standing out from a secondary role, or I should say, you know, a supporting character role in a story like this, because she actually brings out that strength in Victoria as well. So I gave a lot of credit to Derek Sherwin as the writer on this one for making note of those sort of supports, something that he does in a number of the episodes that he ends up writing for Who, both from the Troughton and the Pertwee eras.
Yeah, definitely. So we've got the basic story here of the, you know, the great intelligence coming after the Doctor. All right, I've got to admit, I have not seen the story yet. I know the basic premise of it, but okay. I haven't actually sat down to watch it yet. I know I'm a bad fan, but this is one that I haven't been able to get around to. I've got it sitting on my hard drive waiting for me to watch. Nope. It's just, yeah, it's
totally legit. It's all right. I mean, this is a lot of material to be able to pour through, and especially when you start getting into the fact that there are copies of reconstructions out there, but then there's also the reconstruction that was done for the box set. When the lost episodes were done, which is actually a better quality reconstruction, not to take anything away from what they tried to do for us during the 80s and 90s when they had nothing better to do with their time than do some VHS splicing. That's nice. But it gets really painful to watch every once in a while when it's the same. Every time someone speaks, you've got the same stock photo up on the screen of their face.
Yeah.
It gets rough. So you're dealing with a situation where, you know, we've got this fungus, this web that has been crawling through the underground in London, and has been, they've shut the train systems down to try and coordinate off, and they've sent in military support to try and flush it out or determine what's going on. And you start to find that there are these occurrences of these giant creatures that are being spotted that are moving from sector to sector in London underground. Well, we come to find that this is a return of these robot yetis, which the Second Doctor has grappled with before, in the Abominable Snowmen. And it's the Doctor immediately recognizes the fact that he's dealing with the great intelligence in terms of one of these manipulations. The thing that they don't understand is that the yetis are not supposed to be functioning without control units. These have to be remotely controlled, and all these control units are supposed to be to be non-operational. We come to find out that Dr. Travers, who we met previously, 40 years has passed since the last, well, in Earth time, has passed since we last worked with Professor Travers for the Doctor and Jamie and so forth. It was like a matter of weeks, and they get to play around with that. You know, Jamie walks up to him and has to look at him and recognize him through the beard and the aged face and things. And they explain who they are, and Travers has this moment of realization because for the Doctor, it's been a matter of weeks. For him, it's been 40 years, and we get to really start to play around with the time travel aspects of the program. But I thought it was interesting that we are dealing with knowing who our nemesis is right up front. Mm-hmm. I mean, within the first couple episodes, which is very unusual.
Oh, yeah, especially for the early stuff. I mean, normally it was, you know, at least one episode, sometimes two, before you really understood what the threat was.
Right. And in a lot of the writing they ended up doing with in the Troughton era, they ran long. I mean, we were getting accustomed to Hartnell's stories being told across three or at times four episodes. These were running six at times, or even, you know, when we get down to one of the ones we're going to be mentioning later, runs as far as eight episodes. It was this epic story. So to have this right up front and then start dealing with the ramifications of the fact that you're dealing with, you know, it becomes a big whodunit story because we find that great intelligence has somehow has inside information. So someone among their ranks is either a mole or is being directly manipulated or occupied by the intelligence to get information about what the doctor's actions are with British military intelligence to try and track these things down. But by the third episode, which is the happens to be one of the reconstructed episodes, it was one of the lost materials, we get the first introduction to, at time, Colonel Lethbridge Stewart.
Yeah. Now, see, this. Once I saw this, I was like, oh, okay, now I understand why Keir likes this one so much. This is this is our first introduction to Alistair Gordon.
And, so, and of course, it's, you know, he jumps into it, and he's, because this is right into, it is the, he comes in at the, literally the midpoint of a six-episode murder mystery, really, because characters keep dying, and we're not really certain who the responsible party is or who the mole is. Everyone is suspect, including Lethbridge Stewart.
Right.
So, and they all acknowledge. They all acknowledge the fact that no one is to be trusted. So everybody's trying to keep eyes on one another. And yet you've got some characters who are kind of running around who seem to be the most likely. You know, you've got this reporter who is just oily and you're waiting for him to get his comeuppance because he's just a sleazeball. And then you've got this extremely stupid. Well, he defends himself. You've got this Welsh driver. He's never risen in the ranks of the military any farther than driver, and he keeps saying, you know, in his beautiful Welsh way, I'm nobody important, I'm just a driver, you know. And yet they keep thinking that he could be the most likely suspect because he's always around, but he's a coward and keeps running from situations. So where does he run off to? And, you know, and it's just really well constructed. It definitely gives you something that, despite everyone saying, oh, these classic episodes, they're so slow, they're so boring, they're so talky and nothing ever happens, this flies in the face of that.
Yeah. I mean, this the whole premise of this just, it really reminds me of the old movie Clue, without all the slapstick and everything, but it's like, that's how it is. You've got everybody that's looking sideways to everyone else, and it's just, it does have that feel to it.
Mm-hmm. I'm not going to go anywhere with, because this is one of the ones you can easily access. Get yourself the DVD set to see all these with the restorations, or grab them on iTunes as well, more immediate access. But it's a great opportunity for two things that I noted, and I'm gonna jump back to this a little later. This is one of the on Earth adventures that we have with Troughton. You know, we get accustomed to a lot of this in Pertwee's era because they literally write into the script that he's trapped on Earth. But for all the people that complain about the fact that, you know, when you get into these sci-fi settings and these off-planet scenarios or these future Earth situations where everything is just really horrible sets and it just keeps pulling you out of it because you're noticing the production flaws, here you've got something where it is present day London Underground, you know, bunkers and, you know, and brick walls. You can take all of that out of the equation and focus on the writing, the performances, and the interchange between the actors. And it definitely does a great service to the series in that regard. Because the threat of whatever it is you're dealing with is right there at home, which I would imagine to a viewing audience sells it even better because this is happening right below your feet.
Yeah.
The other point is that this was directed by Douglas Camfield, who has a nice history with who going back into the Hartnell years. He actually had worked with Nicholas Courtney on a earlier episode and wanted to bring him up and give him a more of a prominent opportunity to work a larger role. So created the or helped sort of guide the casting and the creation of Colonel Lethbridge Stewart's character. Now, the writer I mean, there was a the original story premise came from Kit Pedler, who wrote a couple of quick synopsis and short story premises that became later episodes. But the principal writing for it fell into the hands of a gentleman by the name of Derek Sherwin. Derek Sherwin, working back from the Hartnell era, coming into the Troughton era and being able to be one of the primary writers and then head writers, goes on to become a producer for Doctor Who into the Pertwee era. So you're dealing with someone who, before the role really existed, you've got a showrunner on your hands in most forms.
Right. I mean,
so someone who's responsible for a lot of the content creation, but also its execution. So if you get an opportunity, I know there are a couple of documentaries out there that some of the fan created stuff that includes some interviews going back a number of years with Derek Sherwin. Interesting stuff if you want to get your hands on it, or if you grab some of the anniversary compendiums that have been put together that have some discussion about the production crews and the writers and things he's mentioned in there often. Really, really good stuff to chew on, because he was a great force in overseeing some of these developments in the show that we take for granted now. You know, when you're talking about, you know, we had to figure out what we're going to do when we're going to replace lead character. Now we need to redefine, you know, okay, well, let's go back and start talking about these Time Lords. Let's find out more about them. Let's give them a planet. They didn't name it Gallifrey until well after that,
right?
That period. But, you know, these are all things that we're going to have to start infusing the show with. And he had his hands in a lot of that. So a lot of what we consider to be the magic of this program were under his guidance. So give a lot of props to Mr. Sherwin.
Yeah, definitely so. So the next story that we've got is actually The Mind Robber. And this one comes in season six, sorry. Getting to that habit. but this is a season six story, and this is really where a lot of quality stories were coming out of. I mean, this was really good stuff. Mm-hmm. But this one is basically, the TARDIS is stuck in a volcanic eruption, and the Doctor's trying to get him to move. And so when he does that, it takes them out of normal space and time, and they find themselves like in a void. They're there. There's a lot of robots coming after them. And so the Doctor shoves everyone back into the TARDIS and tries to leave, and then the TARDIS just shatters. And everyone's flung off into the void and separated and everything. I mean, it's a really interesting entrance into the story, because you're like, okay, I have no idea what the heck is going on here. Like, let's, that's all, episode one. So then they...
And first episode.
There. Yeah. It's like, okay, TARDIS blew up and now everyone's scattered off into nothingness. Like, all right, I'll be back next week. I don't know what to do. Hopefully you will too. So the whole premise of this story is basically that the Doctor and Jamie and Zoe all wind up in a world that is, you run into all these literary characters. They've got Rapunzel, they've got Gulliver. There's a comic book or a comic strip hero from from like way in the future or something.
They go to the futuristic world of the year 2000, which is great. Yeah. I love it when these things happen.
Yeah. But I mean, you've got, Medusa, a redcoat soldier, D'Artagnan, Sir Lancelot, all of these characters, and you're trying to figure out what the heck is going on here. Like, why are we running into all of these people that are, clearly from a lot of Earth literature? Well, as we go on, we find out that, there's actually someone that's called the Master of the Land. And this threw me the first time I watched it, because they refer to him as the Master. And I'm like, oh, but wait, it's not time for him yet. What? And it really, really took me a while to figure out what was going on, because I had the Master stuck in my head.
different quiet master. I'll fall on my sword in this one. This is one that I haven't been able to watch in probably about a year. And it started, falling into the archives and getting mixed with other episodes. But some of the things that were really the standouts, as I recall, was this was like you're dealing in cases when you're dealing with the master of the land of fiction, or however you want to refer to him, not the master. So you really can't retcon that. It felt to me like one of the classic trickster.
Yeah.
Format episodes, or something where, better yet, if you took a little bit of the menace out of it, it was almost like a Trek and Q to a certain degree, because you couldn't always trust what you were being given, but a lot of times the direct information was being handed to you, but was being done through such a veil of deceit that you didn't know where the true facts lie.
Yeah, and I mean, the master and the doctor both, like, they had a lot of respect for each other. The master kept on saying, you know, the doctor's brilliant, he's fantastic, and he really, really admired him. And likewise, the doctor realized that the master was a very intelligent person, and he had a lot, and it just wound up that they got to the point where they're like, there's no way to resolve this, you know, without one of us going the way of the dodo. You know, they realized that there was no way to finish it without someone losing. So that's where a lot of the tension really comes in, is like in episode 4. Up to that point, you know, it's a constant, like, you know, they're trying to come to an agreement at times, and then there's like little skirmishes here and there, nothing really. One of the interesting things I thought found was, like, in episode 2, Jamie just randomly turns into like a cardboard cutout with no face. And it's like, okay. And the doctor finds this, like, this whiteboard that has chunks of faces on there, and he's got to match it up and make Jamie's face. And the first time he does it wrong. And Jamie comes back, and it's a different actor. And I was like, okay, that's new. Like, is this how they're, like, you know, explaining away the fact that they've got somebody else playing the role now? You know, it's like, oh no, the doctor just put my face back together wrong. I'm still, yeah. But later on, the same thing happens, and the doctor actually gets it right with Zoe's help. So we have the original Jamie back again. It was just, I'm like, okay, what did the guy need, like, you know, 2 weeks off? He's like, hey, look, I've got this thing I've got to go to. Can you just, you know.
And normally they'll just knock you on the head at the end of one episode, and they'll just leave you out of the script for the next episode.
Yeah. No, they actually just replaced him in this one. And I mean, props to the guy that they got to replace him, because it's like, you know, again, like we're talking about, it's not easy, you know, replacing a well-known character and a well-known actor. And the guy actually did a fairly decent job of carrying the character on and staying true to it. It was a little bit weird because his accent wasn't quite right, and it kept on like, oh no, that's not really, but okay. But it was, I mean, it was a lot of fun, and you've got a lot of the, yeah, not so much action. This is a very cerebral episode. I mean, there's a lot of being chased by robots and things like that, but for the most part, this whole confrontation is really cerebral. And it comes down to the doctor outsmarting and, you know, this, that, and the other. And it's a really good episode to show, you know, how the doctor can, you know, use his brain in any situation. And that's what really makes him amazing. But, you know, when you pit him against someone that is, you know, as intelligent, you know, equally intelligent, or just, you know, abnormally smart for humans, so to speak. That's where you get a lot of good interaction from, is when, you know, the doctor actually has to work at being the smart one.
Right. Yep. This is also one of the first episodes where you're now bringing in the adorable little super genius Zoe.
Yes.
as your companion, who not only has kind of great rapport with the doctor, it also kind of it adds to some of the comedy aspect, because now Jamie is the dumb one in the room.
Yeah.
Which is uncomfortable for him, because he's accustomed to being the sort of the right hand of the doctor, and there's times when he's left out of the intellectual conversation and is left to what he does best, which is, you know, thump things with sticks and fall down a lot, and, you know,
but he's so brilliant at it, though.
It is. It's easy to fall down in a kilt. So it's, yeah, definitely one to grab a hold of, because of just the nature of the sort of the meta aspect of it. You know, you're proto meta in the fact that you're taken completely out of any sort of recognizable setting. Yet it looks like the BBC just pulled every set that they had near the soundstage and said, "All right, I need a castle.
Let's go ahead and have a forest.
Let's do that. They don't go together. Well, it's all in black and white. It doesn't matter. Smack them together. That's fine. That'll work out." And it's been done, you know, for so many things since. You know, mentioned that Next Generation did it. Farscape did it with their John Quixote episode. Once Upon a Time. Hell, the whole series is based upon taking literary characters and slamming them into unusual settings.
Yeah.
So you got all that tie in too. Good stuff.
Yeah. And I mean, the fun in this one really comes from the once the Doctor realizes what's going on, that the Master can, you know, is the one writing this story as it goes on. He's writing reality, basically. And the Doctor finds a Master typewriter, and he's able to, you know, combat. So they're both collaboratively writing this story against each other. Mm-hmm. And you've got characters changing from Blackbeard to D'Artagnan. It's like just in mid-sword stroke, they change from one character to another, or, you know, turn into something completely ridiculous. And, right. Yeah, so it's, I mean, it's a lot of fun, and it's just sometimes over-the-top goofball, but it's very entertaining.
Mm-hmm. And I love the fact that this premise, I don't know if this was one of the first times where this has been done. I really don't know how prototypical this might have been, but it's been used, the whole idea of the literally history being written, literally written on the screen being acted out, has been used in a number of instances since, both in sci-fi fiction writing. I think even Stephen King tapped into it for certain things. I know I've seen it done in Supernatural. You had the whole premise of a character who was supposed to be, you know, prophetic, and then what he wrote actually ended up getting carried out. So this is definitely a great example to see that they were very forward thinking from a sci-fi perspective for what you're seeing, you know, screened in what was this, 68, October 68.
So the next story that we've got actually comes directly after the Mind Robber, which is the Invasion.
Right. This, I think, would have to be my choice for the standout, the most shining example of what not only Troughton was putting into the program, but what the entire cast and crew was doing for the show. They really put together this epic story of 8 episodes. Obviously, these were ones that were affected by the loss of content, so episodes 1 and 4 were lost from original film and have been reanimated by the same team who worked on 10th Planet and Reign of Terror and a couple of the other reanimated restorations. But we've got, you know, obviously in this sequence now, Second Doctor, Jamie and Zoe, just coming off the heels of dealing, you know, with the land of fiction here. And they end up trying to travel through space-time and end up with controls that tell them that they've landed. They haven't landed. They've been caught up in this web that has delayed them, that has held them at a fixed point in space for an indeterminate amount of time, and then just suddenly kind of lets them go. And they decide, okay, well, we're not going to get caught up in this again. We're going to dash off and just move ourselves slightly to the left and try to evade it. And they end up on Earth inside a compound run by a company called IE, or International Electromatics. I want to say electronics.
Electromatics, yeah.
Electromatics, because that sounds more official. But we get into this great story where we're dealing with a character in the form of Vaughn, who is very charismatic, but yet you don't really know how evil he is, because he keeps trying to assist as much as he stands in the way of our fair heroes. So for the first couple of episodes, we're just kind of going along with this guy and thinking, well, all right, he doesn't really seem to be doing anything wrong. I just don't feel like I trust him, and I don't know why. And just kind of let these things roll along. And you kind of find that he's working in partnership with some unknown force that is obviously alien in origin, but we don't know to what end. So now we're getting back to what we recognize really well, and that formula of classic Who, of having a villain that's not going to be revealed for quite some time. Well, there, I'm going to put an asterisk on that. Apparently, whatever the British papers typically used for their sort of call it your TV guide at the time, when they were announcing the fact that they were coming into this episode and that it was going to be something they were going to be getting for over the span of 2 months, and they would be really excited about it, they ran a little caption, a little photo with the caption saying what's going to be coming, and they actually put the photo of the Cybermen in the paper.
Yeah.
Before episode 1.
Spoilers.
So, well, nonetheless, for anybody that didn't know that was coming, I think they really did a nice job of starting to kind of telegraph it and saying, oh, he's dealing with, you know, these non-human, emotionless partners. And they keep kind of giving you these little breadcrumbs.
Right.
Until we finally get to, you know, one of these great reveals. I love this particular story.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, this was a lot of keystones for what later came on the show. I mean, we had the return of the Brig, who's actually the Brig at this point.
Yeah, gets his promotion.
Yeah. And this introduces Unit. This is the first story that we see actually Unit come into play. Mm-hmm. So, big deal there. We've got redesigned Cybermen. Thank God, because the old ones were horrible.
Pretty good design too.
Yeah,
I kind of liked them.
And I mean, this was a classic design. They stuck with this until what was it? Revenge of the Cybermen,
I think. Yeah,
something like that. Somewhere in the mid to late 70s. So I mean, they had a good run with this design, and it was a good design. You know, especially when you compare it to the ski masks. But, a lot of stuff came out of this episode, and it was really good stuff.
Mm-hmm. And as far as what we see from the Doctor, because this is really, we want to really discuss what Troughton put into this, some of the aspects we get from him is some of the fact that, and this, you get this over, stupid machines. The line, stupid machines, if you sat there with a ticker and just counted every time you hear someone say stupid machines, even before you knew you were dealing with Cybermen in this thing. But anytime he came up, he explicitly says in one of the episodes, I hate computers and everything that they attempt to do for us. he loves tinkering with little machines. Jamie gets a little transistor radio and he starts taking it apart. He's mucking around with, they're being held in a storage room and there's a security camera watching them. And he slides off to the side and sticks a magnet on the side of it to mess with the lens. Mm-hmm. He loves tinkering, but he hates and distrusts supercomputers.
Yeah.
Which is funny because if you note in the first episode, when they're having trouble with the control panel in the TARDIS and they think that something's wrong, then he actually breaks a handle off the freaking thing and starts like smashing the console with it. He calls his beloved TARDIS, the old girl, a stupid machine. Yeah. 5 minutes into the episode, oh my God.
And I mean, it's got that same effect. Well, I mean, probably more. I mean, when we're all watching the Journey to the Center of the TARDIS and what's his name goes with the laser saw to the door and we all cringe. We're like, no, don't hurt her. And I mean, this was probably a more jarring because it's the Doctor doing it to her. And it's just like, oh, don't, no.
Yeah, man, their relationship hadn't quite solidified at that point, maybe. I don't know.
Before the counseling.
Because of the fact that we deal with all of these great situations of trying to work their way in and out of the IE compound repeatedly, figuring out what's going around in these giant caskets and so forth, and getting to the bottom of that particular mystery, I think Zoe even has a line that sums it up beautifully when she's communicating with Isabel. Incidentally, since they wanted to use, when they wrote this, they wanted to use Professor Travers and his daughter in this, but the actors weren't available, so they actually write them off and say, "Oh, well, they've gone off to America or what have you," and they bring in a near replacement in the form of Professor Watkins, and Isabel, his photographer niece or whatever. But Zoe's got this great line where, if there's trouble to be found, the Doctor and Jamie can't miss it.
Yeah.
And immediately cut to the two of them mucking around in some corridor somewhere, or getting apprehended by security guards like you do. Mm-hmm. It was great. It's such a perfect example of everything in that dynamic that they had at that time.
Yeah, and one of the things I really enjoyed about this story is that up until the very end, the Doctor never gives up on Vaughn. Throughout the whole thing, even once we realize his involvement with the Cybermen and everything like that, the Doctor's working with him. Like, no, look, help humanity. You've got to do that. And eventually, winds up winning him over to where Vaughn does decide to help the human cause.
And I made a particular note of that too. It's that compassion or that, that holding out for the hoping for the best of people until the last possible moment.
And I mean, that's something that we see a lot with the Doctor. And that's, I would say that's a core part of who he is the willingness to, to believe in the best of someone, and when you get to the characters that he has no pause for, like the Daleks, or when he finally gives up on Solomon and dinosaurs on a spaceship, that's the most recent that we can think of that, when he gets to that point, it's such a big deal because of how he is. We understand, when he sees the Dalek and instantly goes on the offensive and is like, no, destroy this thing. You're like, wow, this is the same guy who, you know, somebody will have a gun to his head and he's still trying to win them over. You know, and here's, you know, these villains that he comes across and it's like, nope, you got to die. And it's meant to highlight that aspect of him and to show how evil they are, that not even the Doctor will waste his breath on him.
Talk about a flip. I mean, we were saying last week how we had an instance where the Doctor was trying to understand and reason with the Daleks on First Encounter until he was proven that there was absolutely, you know, no hope for any kind of compassion or partnership or compliance from them. But at the same time, there were situations where, the Kahl or any of these other species where they would get into some sort of a scrape and he'd say, you know, it's not our concern. You know, we can't let our morals get into the way of this. I mean, it's not our battle to fight. Talk about a transition.
Yeah.
Because now you're dealing with someone who will go after Cybermen or Daleks or what have you on site, knowing that there is no way for any sort of a truce, but will take any sort of a human who has gone awry and give him every opportunity until, you know, they literally close themselves off,
right,
or do their own, you know, lead to their own demise. So I think that's the other thing that I noted that's just something that we see a lot through Classic Who, just because we had more of the interaction between the Doctor and Brigadier, was that we get to see right here in this particular episode, they've now had a couple of instances of interaction with one another, literally a couple, and all of a sudden there's this great degree of professional respect and trust between the two of them.
Mm-hmm.
Where there are missions that would normally you would send some sort of a special ops team out to handle, and he sends the Doctor and Jamie in a canoe. But at the same time, you know, there's a later instance in like episode 5 of this or so where the three, call them the three kids, are missing. So Zoe, Jamie, and Isabel are all missing in action, or their whereabouts are as the moment unknown. And the Doctor has to go off and do something on his own, and he leaves the role of responsibility to find and protect them to the Brig, mm-hmm. and goes off and does his thing. So it says a great deal about how their relationship is solidifying as well, which we get to see strengthened again and again and again over the course of the next 20-odd years.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, that's one of the things I love seeing with these early episodes with the Brig, is seeing that relationship form between the two of them, because you know where it ends up and you know how much they mean to each other. So seeing them in these early interactions and seeing, okay, this is where the groundwork is being laid, is just really exciting.
Mm-hmm. Oh, this was also just I'll throw this in here. This is the first time where we get to see Corporal Benton. Who I don't really understand how I'm still not getting this. He's a corporal. That's a pretty respectable rank, and he's driving people around in a Jeep and, you know, listening to the radio to transcribe messages from HQ and so forth. And he's getting all these flunky roles. You're a corporal.
Yeah, but a corporal isn't a brigadier.
There's got to be somebody pushing a broom in the background somewhere that they can grab and say, here, you know, give these kids a ride. They want to go into London. He's driving Jamie around. But
yeah. Well.
But when it really comes down to it, this particular story was one that I consider to be a tour de force for Troughton, because it gave him an opportunity over the course of the many episodes there to really infuse the, as I mentioned before, it's that the zest for and that love for adventure, but the compassion that we just mentioned, the ingenuity and the reasoning and the wanting to understand things from a scientific standpoint as well. So you've got that aspect to really appease those kinds of viewers. And the humor and the physicality, because there's times when they're, you know, falling all over and they're getting, you know, they're getting chased down hallways. Anytime you get to see Patrick Troughton break into a run,
it's hilarious.
No one runs like that. You're never going to make it anywhere. But he does it anyway, because that's what he's committed to. There's just so much energy poured into this epic that you can't help but enjoy it. And you do get a great deal of understanding out of what we really see as the background or the foundations for the modern day Doctor from what we get from Patrick.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, another episode that we didn't really go into in depth in here, but is worth noting, if The other one that we've just recently received is the Enemy of the World, I think. If you're interested in seeing Patrick Troughton's acting chops, this is a great episode just for that, because he plays both the Doctor and the villain Salamander or something. And, I can't remember what he calls it. Something along those lines.
Salamander.
Yeah. But you know, it's such a great... I mean, he does a fantastic job of playing both of those roles and being very distinct in both of them. So, yeah. Well, it's worth checking out.
Yeah, and thankfully, you know, with the few stories that are complete or near complete that you can get your hold on, those are actually not that you can go wrong with any of Troughton's material. Just we genuinely enjoy it that much. But these are some of the ones that that did survive in near entirety and are just a great opportunity to see his work. And especially because of the fact when they get released in the DVD sets, as I mentioned, they tend to clean them up better than anything you'd be able to find out there otherwise. If you've got, you know, great uncles or whatever who keep their VHS collections around, it's not going to be the same. You have to start messing around with your EQ levels just to hear what's going on. Because again, a lot of instances where, and this is something that this particular production team was really a favor of, if you wanted to put intensity into a scene, have people cross-talking.
Yeah.
If your audio quality isn't good, though, all you get is blah, 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 blah.
Very true.
Yeah. I can't imagine what it was like for people that were watching it on those tiny little screens with, you know, one big fat boy, you know, 8-inch mid-range speaker on it, trying to watch in their living rooms as they're all huddled around their couches and trying to make out some of the intricate things that are being said and discussed in some of these episodes.
What are they saying? I don't know. Isn't it brilliant?
Long before closed captioning, so.
Yeah. But yeah. So. But yeah, definitely go and, you know, I don't think that you can go wrong with the Second Doctor. If you can find a story, even if it's not in its entirety, it's well worth it. I mean, he got some quality stuff. So just go and check out anything that you can get your hands on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but, without question.
So we've got some news this week. We're hitting another low point. These happen way too frequently for my taste, but yeah.
Well, sort of go. Let's go in sort of an increasing order of importance here. We'll start from the real trivial stuff. I'm a big audiobook listener, so I tend to plow through a number of them over the course of the week, because I typically will listen to them in the car, or if I'm you know, on a treadmill or whatever, rather than listening to the news or things of that sort. So I tend to go through a good amount of material. And thank you, Big Finish, for just handing me more content than I can keep up with. So at the moment, I've just gone through a bunch of Fifth and Sixth Doctor stuff just for the heck of it, a couple of McCoys for Seventh. But I had been sort of keeping away from a lot of McGann's Eighth Doctor adventures that had been recorded. For various reasons. Maybe it's just because Colin Baker just, you know, out-records him 10-1 on anything that he goes into the studio for. That's changing recently. But so I went back and I grabbed a hold of the Creed of the Crummon, which is a kind of a, call it a queen bee story, you know, insect race that needs to ensure its survival. So they're going to start using another humanoid race as their worker classes. But every once in a while, they're going to find one that they put into the reproductive program and actually hybridize them to become their queen and just sit there and produce larvae. It started out pretty strong. I'm about 3/4 of the way through it. Not really sure. Maybe I'll put a synopsis or my general reactions on the GPR site if you want to go over to gallifreypublicradio.com and we can hash this one out. I started really getting into it, though, because this is an opportunity with a lot of these Eighth Doctor adventures to have him paired up with companions. So Charlotte, or Charlie, who appears in a number of the Eighth Doctor audio plays, is a lot of fun because she reminds me of a lot of those really strong female, Zoe, Donna Noble, the ones who will roll their eyes and tell the spaceman to stuff it if he's off on some tangent. Or even Ace at times, because she's, you know, when Charlie gets short-tempered, she just wants to blast her way out of the situation that she's in. Unlike Ace, though, she's not usually carrying a backpack full of explosives, so she doesn't get to carry that out.
Aw.
Unfortunately. But yeah, but you really, as for those of you who have seen some of McGann's work and want to know what he would have hypothetically been able to do with a television series, this is a great opportunity to really flesh that out. He is a load of fun to listen to because you can see his persona when he plays other roles, but when he drops into the Doctor, he is a very distinctive Doctor. Mm-hmm. Distinctive from all the other that we hold near and dear, but he's a very different Paul McGann as well. So it's a lot of fun to listen to.
Yeah. All right. The next one that we've got is actually the Doctor Who Adventure Games and the Eternity Clock are both available on Steam now.
Yeah. I think they had the Eternity Clock for a little while. But they just recently added the adventure games as well, which is not considered, you know, necessarily a new game. I mean, it's been out since about 2011. It was always a PC format. But Steam is just the way to get your hands on game downloads at this point.
Yeah.
I can't imagine actually going into a Best Buy or something and actually purchasing a disc.
Yeah. I mean, there's some computers now that you don't even have a disc drive anymore. They're just like, oh, everything's going digital. Just leave that out. Right. So, yeah, this is definitely the easiest way to get it. And now, you know, the most convenient and everything. So
I think they now that they picked up this extra title, they actually discounted them both. So you can get them a little cheaper. They're both, I think, both under $20.
Yeah. The Eternity Clock is $9.99 right now. And the Doctor Who Adventure Games, which includes, I want to say, all the adventure games that I don't even think they were available stateside before now, but
yeah, there were four chapters, I guess, is the way that they break it up.
Something like that. Yeah. But those are available for $19.99 on Steam right now. So, yeah.
Sorry, Mac users. Sorry, us.
Yeah.
So only go Windows. Ahead and download Parallels so that you can run Windows. But yeah.
So then the big news that we've got is actually some information we've gotten from Mark Gatiss. Apparently he's talking about bringing the Time Lords and Gallifrey back.
Yeah, or his particular take on whether or not that's the best idea.
Right.
Which was what caught my attention.
Yeah, and I mean, this is something that, you know, has kind of been bouncing around everybody's head. It's like, okay, so we've got Gallifrey back, we saved him from the Time Wars, what does this mean for us? You know, and we kind of had a glimpse of that in the Christmas special, where it's like, okay, everybody thinks that the Time Lords are coming back, let's siege this planet and make sure it doesn't happen. So it's right. Like automatically you've got a planet in the crossfire just for being in the wrong place at the wrong time, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So yeah, this is something that I've been nervous about, saying, okay, if we bring them back, then what is that going to mean for the stories that we're getting? You know, and Gatiss kind of brought that up, saying that, you know, if you show them too much, you get used to them. You know, and that was something he credits RTD with doing, saying, no, we need to put them aside so that we can talk about them and make them this big, powerful race without seeing them and making them, you know, everyday objects that just lose the luster.
Right. Yeah. If you start putting too much of that information into each episode, or if you set an entire episode on Gallifrey, you know, we thought about, you know, what would happen if all of Series 8 was just that quest, you know, that search.
Right.
For the retained Gallifrey. And then we find it. And we have an entire episode where we're now, you know, knee deep in all of the various councils and dealing with the politics and all these things. Does it then cut the legs out from under all of the mystique or at times mistrust for this species that has become, you know, in the Doctor's own words, you know, these series of powerful what does he refer to them as? Powerful incompetence? Or a way, you know, essentially it's the idea that they have seized the opportunity that they went from being regulators of the order of time and upholding the laws into becoming what they saw themselves as minor gods. And if we start putting ourselves in there and getting too much of that information, that brings them back down and realizing how immensely flawed they are, or how ordinary a great degree of them may be, then it loses some of that magic, potentially.
Yeah, and I mean, that's something that I noticed when we were talking about this initially, is a lot of it, you know, when we were talking about making Series 8 the search for Gallifrey kind of thing, is we never really got to the point of, okay, when he finds it, what does that mean? You know, it was always the pursuit. We never thought, okay, what happens when he crosses the finish line?
Right.
So, and I mean, that's something that really is it's going to be very big to the show if that ever does happen. If we ever do get Gallifrey back in the universe proper, it's going to change a lot of things, and not necessarily for the better.
True. So, how do you rein that back in?
Yeah.
At that point, I mean, it's Gatiss's quote was that every time that you go there, it makes them seem a little bit too domesticated. Mm-hmm. You know, and think about what we did in the 50th, where we're dealing with the seeing the military arm of things. You know, right. Seeing some of that structure that was interesting enough, but it was still removed enough from the daily existence, mm-hmm. and that sort of thing. So I know the article that particularly tipped this off to us brought up an interesting kind of thought, and they said, you know, if there's with that warning or with that concern that they would have to be, if they're going to be brought back into some sort of regular discussion or appearance, that it has to be done very, very carefully, mm-hmm. that how can you involve them without having them be too intrinsically involved? And the writer's theory was that maybe this means that we have to have another of our rogue Time Lords in the mix. We do already know that we've had a lot of things kicking around in the rumor mill about the return of the Master, mm-hmm. you know, for whatever grounding that actually has. How might that fit into some sort of a master plan? Nice.
Well done.
Sorry. I'm going to edit that, myself out of that one.
That's Kier at GallifreyPublicRadio.com.
Yarp.
One thing that I was thinking that would be kind of interesting, if they do manage to bring him back, and I mean the problem you run into is, think about, I mean, we just talked last week about the first appearance of the Daleks and how at the time it was a terrifying thing. The Daleks were truly terrifying at that point. And then, you know, add 50 years to it and we've got, you know, Donna spinning them in circles and everybody laughing at the fact that they're defeated so easily. And, you know, it's up until Asylum of the Daleks, nobody thought of them as scary anymore. Mm. Yeah, and even now, there's still people that are like, okay, that was a good episode, but they're Daleks. Come on, really? I mean,
yeah. Can't you just knock them over?
Yeah, just give them a good kick. They'll fall over and, you know, problem solved. But the thing is, if you bring the Time Lords back a lot like that, then how much are they going to lose? You know, we've spent the past 8 series building them up as this, you know, this powerful, or 7 series, sorry, this powerful race that, you know, they're lamented and they're missed and they're, you know, vilified a lot of times as well. And, you know, all of the stuff that went into it, and it can be undone so quickly. But I think if they do bring them back, it has to be used sparingly. And I mean, like, very not showing up once a series like the Daleks, like very sparingly. And when they do, half the time they need to be allies and half the time they need to be opponents. You know, not necessarily the villains, but they're doing something that, you know, is bad and the Doctor needs to stop them.
I don't have a solution set for this. I don't even have the earliest inclinations of how they could possibly solve the Lost Gallifrey scenario without putting us into a great risk of overexposure, mm-hmm. to Gallifreyan minutiae.
Yeah. I mean, I think that the search for Gallifrey needs to be a long plan kind of thing. They need to drag this one out as long as they possibly can, and not necessarily end it with Gallifrey coming back. Mm. You know, having it be maybe, hey, there's a wormhole that opens up that we can get people through for, like, you know, 5 minutes at a time every 6,000 millennia. You know, it's like, make it something that's very, very rare so that, you know, the writers can, hey, look, here's, you know, the thing happened again. We've got a time machine. We can travel to that time, but whatever. You know, bring it in when they need to, but have it be something that's so rare that, you know, they're not doing it all the time. You don't go to that well.
Well, we shall see. Again, this is another one where we'll put it out to the masses to kind of share some thoughts on this, because I know, you know, with everything kind of fresh in our minds with, you know, Gallifrey stands and that whole resurgence, mm-hmm. you know, in terms of being able to now consider something that we had written off, we'd really forgotten quite a bit about, you know, Razlan and Kin and everything going on there with the High Council until we got around to the 50th. And now that it's all fresh in our heads, now we get to deal with these kind of hypotheticals again.
Yeah.
So,
isn't it fun?
Yeah. Of course. If it wasn't fun, we wouldn't talk about it.
Yeah. So next week we are going to be talking about the Third Doctor. I'm kind of looking forward to this one. I mean, things are starting to pick up. And yeah, not that the first or second Doctor had bad stuff, but it's just, you know, the third and fourth Doctor were really the prime of the series in the classic age, where, you know, this is where everybody went on Saturdays. Yeah, mm-hmm. Everybody knew it and everybody looked forward to it. I mean, third and fourth Doctor are some quality gents.
Yeah, absolutely. So we will get ourselves tattooed arm deep into the Pertwee era next week. And so again, if you've got episodes that particularly stand out, or just opinions on his contribution to the legacy, by all means, you know, chime in with us. We'd love to get that discussion going with you. Yeah. So I would say at this point, I know a lot of folks are starting to feel those doldrums of not having some new material, some new content, or any news from the front, other than a couple of on location photos and things that come out in dribs and drabs. It's not a Minotaur, okay? That alien thing. Don't just please stop with the Minotaur. You know, we defended that last week that it wasn't going to be a freaking Minotaur, and turns out it wasn't. So there you go. Ha, victory.
We know stuff.
but again, and I've been tipping off a lot of people. Go get the audiobooks. Go grab the novelizations. Just go grab the extended content. Enjoy some of the expanded universe while you've got this time. It's a nice long stretch, but you've got so many stories that you've never been exposed to. So many companions you've never been introduced to, and just so many possibilities to enjoy more of your favorite Doctor. Doesn't matter which one it is, because there's content out there for you with your Doctor, written in beautiful voices, you know, to carry those stories on. But this is by no means downtime.
Yeah, definitely not. Right, well, this has been episode 79 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, our lives are different than anybody else's. That's the exciting thing. Nobody can do what we're doing.
And this is Keir saying in my worst Welsh accent ever, I may be stupid, but I'm not daft.
We'll see you guys next week.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com. Tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio or on Facebook at facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows by calling 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1477 to leave us a voicemail. You can head to GallifreyPublicRadio.com to leave comments on each episode. There you can also keep up to date on all the latest news and gossip, as well as what's going on in the community. Also, make sure to head over to GunnaGeek.com to find out lots of other high-quality, geek-centric shows. Music by Beyond the Epilogue and Retcon Addict.
Gallifrey Public Radio is copyright 2014.